Welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and joined for the purposes of this intro by my good friend, colleague, contributor, and organiser of these podcasts, Miles Dacres. Hello, Miles.
Hello, Ollie. I didn't quite realise I had so many titles. That's nice to hear.
That's not even your official work title in there.
It's not. No, it was a really, 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 really good session today. I'm extra happy because we've hit 150 listeners for the first time in a long time. The first time in 2022. I think it was actually our last session where we discussed SARS when we reached 150. So great to see so many people down today.
Absolutely. And unlike this intro, we most certainly did not riff that session. It was one of the most prepared that we've done in a while. And quite rightly so, as for once, we weren't joined by our regular contributors, Phil and Dave, as unfortunately they're away this week. We were instead joined by a debutant to the podcast. You'll hear her introduce herself in greater detail in the recording, but that's Carrie James, one of our new consultants. We're very pleased to have her on board. And I have to say, I think she did a sterling job on this week's episode.
She did an amazing job, but better than can be expected of anybody joining that madness there for the way that she handled the questions and everything like that. So, yeah, we'll definitely look to have Carrie back on in the near future.
100%. And I was even a bit cheeky at one point and put her on the spot, which, as I say at the time, I wouldn't normally do to the other two. So I'm being a bit mean to her, but she handled it admirably. And yeah, I thought it was a really excellent session. It's a particularly, what's the word? Not necessarily popular topic, because people really sort of either hate or love this subject, but
infamous, perhaps.
Certainly a busy one. Yeah, infamous, possibly the right word. It was a busy session, let's put it like that.
It was indeed, and plenty of activity in the chat. It was almost hard to keep up with the number of questions and queries coming in, actually.
I'll be honest with you, it was borderline impossible to keep up, and there's a bit of dead air for a couple of seconds. You might have to edit out where I really sort of lost my train of thought because I was trying to keep up with the chat and it didn't go well for me. but I think I can be excused. But yeah, no, fantastic session. Really good. We'll be doing a part two to it because there's so much still to talk about. We've not set a date for that yet, have we, Miles? But we'll find a space in the diary.
We haven't. We should find one pretty quickly. I'm thinking we should just trade out one of our GDPR radio sessions in the coming month and trade it out for a part two of the session with it being so popular. We would switch it for next week's GDPR session, but we are celebrating Data Protection Day, or Data Privacy Day rather, which is obviously one of our favourite days of the year. And we did celebrate last year with a 6-hour long podcast. And we wanted to do something to beat it this time, but we're actually just going to be hosting a live session with you, Dave, and Phil. Lots of quizzes, lots of interactive stuff going on during that session. So it should be a fun week next week.
Yeah, and I think we're preparing some content to go out on the socials as well, so people can keep an eye out for that. Speaking of content. Is it finally timed to stop teasing this release and actually properly announce that from Monday, the new DPP website is live? Am I all right to do that, or am I still being overzealous?
No, you are indeed right to do that, Ollie. We finally overcome the last hurdles, and the site is ready to go live on Monday. So loads of features on there. The podcast will actually be featured on the website in future, as well as podcast and Apple Music. So if you are a regular listener, it may actually be more efficient for you to listen to it through our website. We've made sure it's nice and speedy for you, and also any resources that are mentioned throughout the chats can be put on there as well. We do actually have a lot of people who listen to us on Spotify, and they might reach out and say, oh, you've mentioned this article, or you've mentioned this document, and would you be able to send it over to us? And we're hoping that by hosting the podcast on our website, that people will be able to tap into all the resources they need and listen back to any good conversations that we have.
Yeah, 100%. So looking forward to that. The podcast just continues to grow. As you said, we had record numbers for the year today. So that's excellent to see. In order to keep pushing that, I'm sorry to bang on about every week, but if you could leave us a rating on your platform of choice, if you enjoy the podcast, that would be greatly appreciated. Because quite frankly, some of our key contributors now in terms of guests who come on and attend each week and support us and even sometimes unmute and dive in are people who have found us just through the ether, and we're really glad to have them. And if we could replicate that with anyone else, then we'd be absolutely chuffed a bit, quite frankly. So any ratings appreciated. Anyway, you and I have waffled on more than enough, haven't we? Let's leave it there for now. Let's get stuck in, because there's plenty of content in this one. So without further ado, I shall leave you in the very new but surprising, no, it's not surprising actually, that's not fair, very new but very impressive, capable hands of Carrie James and, as per usual, myself. Welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. My name is Ollie Rear. I'm your host for these sessions. I am, however, not joined by my usual companions this week. David Holmes and Phil Brining, unfortunately, cannot be with us, but that's no problem at all, because I am delighted to be joined by a debutant this week. New DPP consultant just joined us recently, but I'll let her introduce herself. That's Carrie James. Hello, Carrie.
Hi, Ollie. I'm really excited to be here. I never in my life thought I'd be doing a podcast that ends up with my voice on Spotify, but you know, new things happen all the time.
There's a first time for everything.
Definitely.
So before we get started, do you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself, not to put you on the spot or anything, but just so that those of the listeners who haven't met you before can get to know you a little bit?
Yeah, so I've been in data protection for coming up to 4 years this summer. In my previous job, I was in a different consultancy, and they had a client base that was mainly public sector. So there was councils and a lot of schools. So I've had plenty of SAR experience from those organisations. Been really happy to be at DPP, getting stuck into some different sectors, something a little bit different for me, charities, housing associations. But there is a lot of crossover that I've already found with those organisations, so my old experience is useful for the new.
Absolutely, there's plenty of common themes. And speaking of which, we've not actually introduced today's session, so that's a lovely segue. Thank you, Carrie, you're getting the hang of this. We're talking about subject access requests today, one of the most popular topic, one of the most, I suppose, infamous topics, really, in the context of data protection, a pain point for a lot of organisations. So we'll be talking about how to simplify the subject access request process, I think, broadly today. But before that, we always like to do a little bit of what's been in the news, and in particular this week, there's an item which we thought was particularly pertinent to raise, as it's about subject access requests, and that is this piece of enforcement action from the ICO, enforcement notice served on the Ministry of Justice. So, Carrie, you initially brought this to my attention. I don't know if you wanted to talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie. I did laugh when I saw this, just because of the ridiculous number involved. And when you read through the enforcement action, sort of, it's like an ongoing saga for the Ministry of Justice. So they've had an enforcement action from the ICO, as Ollie said, on the 18th for 7,753 late SARs. It's an absolutely mind-boggling number of SARs that are late. Nobody's a stranger to a late SAR, but 7,500 of them is, I don't even know how they, I mean, they can't have any organisation for this. I don't understand how they handle this. But it's not new to the Ministry of Justice. They've actually had previous enforcement under the old DPA 98 Act, also for late SARs. So it looks like this has been an ongoing problem since 2017, with the ICO involved at different stages to try and push them to get these backlog of SARs cleared. The Ministry of Justice have says that a lot of these SARs have been partially responded to, but it's not quite clear what the partial response is. Is it that they've responded to the person to say, yes, we hold some information, and given them a little bit of basic information that's really easy to find? Or is it that they've given them a half done SAR and that the other half still needs to go? It's not quite clear how far along the partially finished route it is. There are a number of them that are also haven't been answered at all since 2018.
Yeah.
Ministry of Justice have had a number of excuses. They've jumped on the pandemic excuse, like a lot of organisations have said, pandemic, you know, stressing us out, putting pressure on. So the ICO kind of gave them some more time. The interesting thing I thought about this as well is that whilst there's thousands of late SARs, the ICO have said they've only had 34 complaints. And I'm really surprised by how small that number is compared to the amount of delayed SARs there are from years. So I'm not quite sure what's happened there, why are people not aware maybe that they can complain to the ICO for the delayed SAR, or are people choosing not to, or is it maybe that some of these cases are that they're time sensitive, so it's solicitors requiring things for a court date for immigration documents where things have a set deadline, that once that deadline is passed, the applicant, you know, there's no point for them then chasing that up, so they've not complained to the ICO for that reason.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, it begs the question of whether their partial response strategy has worked to an extent. Michael reckons it's probably apathy, which is relatively. Yeah, I don't think is a bad suggestion. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the partial response thing I picked out, as you did, from what I could tell, reading between the lines a little bit, because you say it's not clear. What they seem to be saying is that their partial response is effectively what they can access readily and easily and provide readily and easily. So they've effectively just whatever they could extract within a short turnaround, they've sent across. But anything that requires a little bit more work is what they've not supplied. And one of the things I did pick out seemed to be that it sounds like it's potentially partly supply chain led, in that, I mean, there was a part that was redacted, so it's not necessarily clear, but it seemed to say that they struggled because they couldn't access something. And that sort of seems to indicate, and I say the rest is redacted, but that sort of seems to indicate that it's a supply chain issue potentially, which is pretty poor. But there are some other interesting bits I noticed. I don't know whether you saw this, but the ICO have brought this under both the DPA and quote unquote the law enforcement directive. So they've brought it under both parts because part of it relates to criminal conviction or offence data, which I thought was also interesting. As you say, I mean, it's slightly flaky excuse, the pandemic, but more so I think because so much of it relates to pre-pandemic. So really, your excuse is a bit weak. I don't know if you had any other thoughts on that. I'm just going to keep it on the chat because this is really sort of generating some interest.
Like you say, like it's sort of pre-pandemic. So whatever issues they've got with their processes internally clearly haven't been resolved since the enforcement notice under the old act. They've just continued, or whatever process they've put in place to try and rectify the issues failed. The other thing I thought was quite interesting as well is that the ICO have actually given them until December this year to answer it. They have got a full year to clear this backlog. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested if the ICO would go back in at the end of the year and say how many they've actually cleared, or if we're just going to be seeing another enforcement notice or a fine at the start of next year.
I saw that, and I also saw that they said that it's not the year is to both clear the backlog but also implement fresh processes to deal with this in future and to stop it happening again, which is nice to see. According to Emma seems to have done the maths on it and reckons that that will be 50 a day to clear that backlog by December, which is quite substantial. There are a couple of other interesting bits actually that I'd like to pick up on here. Rick's asking whether it's potentially to do with the asylum seeker / immigration exemption of the DPA, which is interesting because obviously that's been ruled unlawful, so insufficient fulfillment rights could kick in. That's a very interesting take. I do wonder whether that's anything to do with it. Jill's asking whether the reported late SARs are those that go over the 3-month mark. You might have found this, Carrie, but I didn't see anything to indicate whether it was that they were past 1 month, past 3 months, or any variation of that. But I do know that some of them were sort of 4 years old, effectively.
Yeah, it didn't there wasn't really any mention of whether any of these, like whether they'd attempted to extend the deadline themselves and it had gone out of an extended deadline. So I've sort of taken it to mean that they didn't even get to applying an extension to some of these, that they've all just gone late from the 1 month mark. But I think some of it might be that if they're quite old, it might be that they could close them as answered. But I think maybe if they've got this many, they've possibly lost a handle on like just the administration of them all.
Yeah.
So some of these are possibly that they could be closed as final and done, but nobody has gone back and done that. So when they've ran whatever report they needed to do to figure out the numbers, it's just come back with everything that's open. But it might not be a true picture.
No, I think that's spot on, to be honest with you. I think that's absolutely right. But I think one of the things, and sorry to set up the segue this early because I've got another piece of news to talk about, but in relation to one of the top tips I wanted to talk about about SARS, is I think what this has to indicate clearly, if they're getting this many SARS in as part of their regular processes, then surely that indicates that there's some sort of you know, niche there to be addressed, that there's, whether it's an issue with transparency potentially, i.e. people feel like the processes are too opaque and therefore they're putting in these SARS, or surely there's an opportunity to just say, well, if all of this information is being requested by everyone who comes through these doors anyway, let's just make it readily accessible and available.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they're just too bogged down.
They just give it back to them. Like, exactly. You know, the end of whatever they're doing, you know, and here is your file. You know, do you want a copy of your file and have it built into just standard processes? Whereas it kind of looks like they have it as, I don't even know. I mean, I just can't get my head around the numbers.
Yeah, same. And I think I can understand the partial response thing, but as you're saying, like from an administration perspective, surely it's beneficial to potentially delay others so that you can find properly complete and sign off on existing ones before you tackle new ones. But I don't know, I'm not close enough to it really.
Be interesting to know how many staff they have as their SAR team as well, because if they've only got a handful of people, they're never going to get through 50 a day.
Well, this is the thing, I think Mark raised this in the chat, saying he finds it hard to believe that they don't have, you know, sufficient staff there, considering it's the MOJ, but who knows? Sorry, I'm just dealing with the poll that Miles has put in the chat. It's somewhat made things go haywire for me, so I do apologise.
Yeah, it's done it for me as well. I don't know whether to click cancel or continue.
Sorry, Ollie, I didn't think that one through.
No worries, Miles. Mark, do you want to jump in? I see you got your hand up.
Yeah, no problems, Ben. I was just going to talk about a previous place of work where I was working in a team of seven of us, and we faced a continual backlog, but we only received something like 30 a month, and there were seven of us working on it, and we got to a point where we were just concentrating on the head of the queue, and then just constantly just making sure that the new ones that were coming in were added to the back of the queue. But we managed fine. I mean, we still managed to get them out in time. I am literally staggered at the amount of DSARs, and this is the Ministry of Justice we're talking about. You know, I'm definitely going to go away and dig further into this and have a good old read about this one.
You do, right. Sorry, just quick correction. Emma's saying that it's not 50 a day, it's 30 a day, 150
still
a week.
still a lot,
but but it's what you say, Mark. At a certain point, I mean, that number hasn't just crept up on them. That's not how these things work. It's not they've woken up one day and gone, oh, crikey, we've got 7,000 out of nowhere. You know, this has been pottering away in the background for some time now. So surely at some point they have to bite the bullet, grab the bull by the horns, and actually get on top of this. But
it could just be,
who knows what the issue is.
It just could be poor management, and they just need somebody like, you know, Kath Midgley on the case. We need to send her in.
I fear for them if we send Kath Midgley in. There'll be big trouble. Yes, sorry, I just got distracted by something in the chat again. So Miles is asking everyone for how many DSARs do we receive a month into each organisation. So any responses to that, much appreciated. Be interesting to see the results of that towards the end of the session. There's just one other bit of news I've seen this week, which I only bring it up because it's a bit of an update. So a couple of weeks or maybe a month ago, we brought you news that the Gloucester City Council website had suffered a cyber attack, that substantial parts of that were down. That is still the case, as far as I can tell, because I read an update on it this week. One of the things that came out is they reckon that the malware in question was delivered by an email into their system. So it really reiterates, I guess, the importance of making sure that staff are trained on this sort of thing, and not overlooking the potential danger that can come from compromising emails. There's also a claim in the article I read that someone at least thinks that it's Russian hackers behind it. And while I can believe that Russian hackers would be attacking the Kiev infrastructure in Ukraine, I'm not entirely sure why they'd be interested in Gloucester, but who knows? Maybe I'm just being a bit cynical. Any other news, Carrie, before we talk about some of our key top tips for sales?
Yeah, I've seen a few little bits this week. One of them has been raised by one of my clients as well, but I'd seen it, I think it might have been Joe that put the link in our team kit, about the Austrian Data Protection Authority have decided that continuous use of Google Analytics violates the EU GDPR.
Yes.
This is sort of the same, this sort of following on from Screms 2 as well, where the Privacy Shield was deemed not fit for purpose anymore. This is because Google Analytics falls under US surveillance laws as well. They can send, like Google Analytics and Facebook, places like that, they can send information to the US government if needed. I'm not quite sure at the minute what this would mean for the UK, but I'm going to do some more digging. It's only come out in the last couple of days, so I want to sort of do a bit more reading on that, sort of see how that might affect the UK, because whilst we don't come under EU GDPR, we've got our own UK GDPR. This, you know, this the issue without having the Privacy Shield there, that's still applicable to the UK.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's one of these ones we mentioned last week of the backlog of complaints that Max Schrems's outfit has been putting in. So interesting to see those continue to fall, and I'm sure we'll continue to bring updates on that as the rulings continue to come out. Anything else on that, Carrie?
Yeah, I've got one other tiny bit which came from a link which I found on LinkedIn. I couldn't actually read the article itself because it's not in English, so it would be really interesting if I could read it. The Belgian Data Protection Authority have imposed a fine on a bank for appointing a DPO with conflicting roles. So they found that this DPO was the head of operational risk management, information risk management, special investigation unit departments, and they decided that in this capacity, the way this person's working with the data, because they're concerned with how it's processed and the purposes and all things like that, that it's actually a conflict of interest, because DPO is supposed to be more sort of, I can't think of the word.
Independent.
Independent, yes, that's the word I'm thinking of. so I thought that's something sort of I don't really come across very often anyway, people having those conflicting roles. They're usually kept quite separate. But I just thought it was quite interesting that it popped up on my LinkedIn. It would have been interesting to read the full article, but...
Well, Rick has found you a link in the... Rick's found you a link in the chat, Carrie. There you go.
Is there a link to it in English?
Right there in the chat from Rick.
Fantastic, Rick. I will definitely read that.
But no, it's interesting. And I suppose one of the things that slightly that highlights is that I suppose it's the thing that you're far less likely to be exposed to in the context of the public sector, in terms of potentially those overlap of roles. So, yeah, it's always interesting to see those nuances because, you know, private sector, we do tend to see potentially a head of IT who's also being the DPO, and that can sometimes be a little bit conflict of interesty, and a whole host of other roles. So yes, it is always interesting to see that sort of thing.
I think public sector are very used to working within defined rules and regulations and things already, that they're kind of used to, okay, well, we can't conflict with this, we can't conflict with that, whereas private organisations might be less stringent on things and maybe don't pick up on those nuances in the legislation.
Yeah, quite possibly. Quite possibly. Right, so let's talk DSARs then, shall we? Let's get stuck into the main thing. So we've got I've put together a list of key points here for simplifying the SAR process, the handling of SARs. I probably should have organised this according to where in the process it falls, so that's probably on me. But I will keep my killer one for later because I've got a number one key recommendation as I tend to have around this. But I don't know if there are any ones you wanted to start with, Carrie. For me, one of the interesting ones that's come out recently that I've seen increasingly this year is around communication. So one thing I've noticed on a couple of occasions is within my clients' businesses that we've had instances where a SAR has been correctly recognised by a member of staff. It has been logged as such, but then somehow along the way has not been communicated to the right department, whether that's the DPO or a lead or anything like that. And that really surely has to be one of the single worst ways to potentially jeopardise your process of just basic communication. I don't know if that's something you've ever seen, but
yeah,
it's something which I'm really trying to focus on.
Yeah, it can be. It can be just that people maybe don't quite recognise things as a SAR when they come in, and then they might not pass it on to their manager or to somebody else. Could be a couple of days, but that's a couple of days that could have been worked on the SAR that, you know, because it's coming, it could come into anybody in an organisation. It doesn't have to specifically come to the DPO to be a SAR, but you need everybody in the organisation to recognise these requests, because otherwise you could just waste time passing it around different departments before it gets to the right person.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I saw one recently where one of my clients was all in a panic because they had 48 hours left to handle a SAR because it had just gone missing somewhere in transit. Someone had sent an email to the wrong place or not followed it up, and as a result of that, you've eating up almost your entire month just because the DPO hasn't become aware of it, or the team that handle it hasn't become aware of it. So I think that's one to focus on. I don't know what your first recommendation would be though.
I think mine would be along communication as well, but I think communication with the data subject. I think with SARs, customer service can go a very long way in getting data subject on your side with this, especially if you think it's going to be late or there's been an unexpected delay with it. I've found that even if you've not been able to extend the deadline but it's gone late, just communicating with the data subject can make that relationship go a lot smoothly. You know, you've less chance of being asked for internal reviews, less chance of it going to the ICO if you just inform the data subject of, you know, apologize, it's going to be late, we've had a hiccup on something, whatever it might be. And then give them a new estimated date when you think it might be done.
No, absolutely. Sorry, I was just seeing that Rick
chat's going
was
mad.
Saying that, yeah, Rick saying that he got one handed over the day before the deadline once, with the line, "Do we have a process for these?" Which, crikey Moses, can you imagine? But no, I think you're right. This is something that I completely agree with you on. And I think broadly, when I've been writing this up, I've brought it within the broader remit of scoping, I think, which obviously does include multiple limbs. But you're right. Having that initial conversation of just saying, you know, well, what is it you're after fundamentally? And I know that some will point out that the law is supposed to be purpose blind, and these requests are intended to be purpose blind, but that's never the case. You know, there's always people very rarely put in SARs for the sake of it. There will 90% of the time be a reason, and if you can just discuss that with them and say, right, well, what is it you're after, what format are you looking for, you know, what are you looking to do with this fundamentally, just helps instantly. You know, adjust expectations. It helps you in your search. You know what you're looking for. You know what to provide back to them. And yeah, generally, I can only think that it helps. Now, obviously, that's probably not always possible. But you know, if it can be done, then I'd certainly recommend, yeah, communication with the data subjects along those lines.
I've had it before where somebody wanted an entire file. They wanted it at short notice for, I think it might have been a court date or something. I ended up calling the person saying, look, we can't do this within this time scale. It's not possible. Is there something specific in your file that you're looking for that we could possibly do in a shorter timeline? Get that bit out to you for your court date and then send the rest after that. And they were like, yeah, okay, I just want this bit for this particular thing, but they wanted to see the whole file anyway. And it worked out really well in the end. The person was, you know, really grateful for my help, that they managed to get the information soon, and that they had like the heads up and, you know, about that actually they won't get the whole file, instead of just being left in the dark of, are they going to get it before the date, are they not? They knew they weren't going to get the bulk of it, but they knew there was a good chance of them getting the little bit they'd asked for.
Yeah, 100%. And this is one of the things that is currently being talked about quite a lot in the chat, is around the complaint element. And it is, you know, I have seen in a lot of organisations, and particularly in social housing, you get this sort of thunder and lightning type of arrangement where if a complaint comes in, the SAR's never too far behind, or vice versa. And I mean, what that tends to highlight, and I think this is one of the things that Michael is saying, although I've seemed to have lost his message, but one of the things that he's saying, which is that sometimes you get this communication, so a request to erase data, or maybe it's an access request or whatever it is, and I am extrapolating here slightly from his original message, but you get this sort of reaction where, well, we'll deal with the SAR, deal with the erasure request, whatever it is. And then the root cause of that might fall by the wayside a little bit. And you end up sort of going, well, we're not addressing the root cause of this issue. And it's something which Dave Holmes wants to bring up today, although obviously he can't be here, which is that he has a real issue with KPIs. Not to say that he doesn't think they're valuable, but, and I know he's spoken about it on this podcast before, but KPIs for the sake of KPIs, he has a real issue with. And the reason I raised this is because he was in a meeting yesterday, he was telling me, where they were saying that instead of just monitoring, you know, the turnaround time for SARs and how many they get, they were also monitoring, quite rightly, what those SARs were in relation to. And this was a housing provider. And he was saying that a lot of them, a worrying percentage of them, were coming in relation to disrepair claims. Now, what that should be telling you is that there's an issue here that we can look to address. And in the long run, that then brings down your number of SARs, instead of just sort of treating the symptom rather than the cause, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it's a valid point. And it does sort of come back to that purpose blind thing that we were talking about just previously. But it can be difficult dealing with this sort of thing. There's a lot of, just so that we can pick this up now before it gets lost in the chat, there's a lot of talk about rightly.co.uk.
That one, which, at My Data, I think Rob put a link into. I've come across both of them in my old role.
Yeah, I've also come across one called Privacy B, which I think is an American one. But effectively, for those who maybe aren't familiar, what we're talking about here are third-party platforms which allow individuals to fire out erasure requests or access requests. And there's a lot of chat about how legitimate these are and whether they are actually to be responded to. As far as I'm aware, the latest ICO guidance says that they are perfectly legitimate, but, and I'm treading carefully with my wording here, I think there isn't necessarily an obligation to respond to them if you are required to provide your response through that platform or something to that effect. I'm happy for someone to come and challenge me on this, but if I'm racking my brains, that is the latest stance, which is you can use these platforms, but you have to be able to allow the controller to respond to you as they intend and not be constrained to that platform. Andrea, you've got your hand up. Do you want to challenge me on that?
Not so much of a challenge, but I did call ICO as well about this, and I was told that, you know, all these apps, they require you to create an account and log in in order to fly. Well, why should I as a company be forced to do that? It's like I have nothing else to do. I need to create an account every time. And if I receive, I received 97, not SARs, but deletion requests last month via another app, I'm not going to go and log in with all of them and so on. So ICO said no. And this is the guidance I read as well. Companies should not be forced to create an account, log in, and deal with all this because apps have decided to. I never directly interact with apps, so I always directly interact with the data subject. I called ICO in terms of ID validation as well. I said, okay, I'm directly emailing the data subject, doing my ID validation process. If they reply, that's okay. If they don't reply, I'm not going to take as an answer whatever the app sends me. And they said that that's okay. If you believe that's not the right process to ID validate the data subject, that's okay. So I think that we do not, I mean, the way I see it, I don't have to go and log in, create an account, and directly deal or liaise with an app. No, and I don't think a supervisory authority in Europe or UK, because we cover global territories, I don't think they believe that as well. That's my opinion, and that's how we are dealing with them, so yeah.
I tend to support you. Yeah 100%. I think that's perfectly valid, and by the looks of it, everyone in the chat seems to support you as well on this, which is that we're not going to deal with them, or some people saying that they sort of circumvent it by either CCing in the platform when they respond, but respond directly to the individual. Or I think it's probably quite right, because I can understand the attraction of these platforms, and I can understand that they have a place, particularly the Erasure ones, in that if you want to get off the grid. But it has to be proportionate, and you're absolutely right, Andrea, that forcing an organization to have a login for this and etc. is I think disproportionate, possibly. Carrie, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, we always said we never used to get many Erasure ones, I don't think. Most of them came for as SARs. And for us, the concern was that we would be uploading, potentially sensitive information to a third party platform that the organisation would have no link to, no contract with. It just always seemed a little bit dodgy to me.
Yeah.
So we would always try and deal with the requester directly and explain you don't have to use a third party platform to put in a request. Just tell us what it is you want. I don't know if any of these third party platforms make money from people either, that if they get like a successful, upload of information or anything, if they have to pay for these services, for these third party websites to send it over to organizations.
Some of them definitely do, because when I looked at Privacy B for one of my customers who was getting a Erasure request through them, you could have a free account, but you could also pay a subscription service to get you scrubbed off the internet as much as they could possibly do. What would the incentive be for these platforms to exist if there's not some sort of commercial revenue? Tap My Data is an interesting one that Rob put in, because I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, Rob, but that's one of the ones which offers sort of rewards and prizes to the user for deleting their data or putting in access requests. I might be wrong, but I vaguely remember that being part of the appeal of it, which is, surely that starts to trigger the manifestly unfounded aspect of all this. Rob says, yes, it offers a tokenized reward system. So I'd have thought that's manifestly unfounded personally, but that's just my opinion. One of the interesting things in here, Carrie, and I don't know if this is something you'd have been confronted with in the context of the public sector, because this sort of thing, the public sector, because that's one of the things I associate with, but James saying that they have a very small team and they find that one of their biggest issues is in delivering the information when the requester insists on having the records in a physical paper format, especially when we could be looking at over 10 years of information. And this is something that I have seen, which is, no, I don't want it digitally. I'm demanding to have a physical paper copy of it. Now, I don't know if that's something you've come across much, but it's definitely a tricky balancing act, that, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it is, and it can definitely be onerous when you're looking at things like a foster care file where the child's been in foster care since they were very young. You know, a great deal of information is written in that time period. I'm trying to think, so my team specifically, we would look at the SARs, but we would never be the ones responsible for sending them out to the data subject. That would be, you know, back to the teams who've collated the information. I think sometimes they would end up posting them out, but more often than not, we try to convince them to have it as a digital format, just because sending it out as paper comes with other risks, such as getting lost in the post.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if they have a digital version, they could, you know, the council could set up a specific drive that you could have access to for a limited time, you know, just have a secure method of sending it to the data subject. Some of them did go out in paper when people have had specific requests, so they've needed it in large print, they've needed it on a specific color paper so it's easier for them to read, so when they've had extra requirements like that, things have gone out in paper just so that we can then be accommodating, so then mm-hmm. people can't have access to the information. But I'm pretty sure that most of them went out digitally. I think they're trying to move away from printing just because of the, you know, it is an onerous task.
No, of course it is. I mean, the approach that some of my customers have taken, I've supported them on this, particularly where they have, what's the politically nice way of saying this? Frequent flyers is a term I've heard used in their SAR bureau. Yeah, really racking up the air miles on the on the SAR service. And where they have refused to take something digitally and instead asked for a paper copy, they've said, well, we've already provided you with one copy, so this, we're going to consider this to be an additional copy, and therefore we're going to charge you based on the reasonable fee scheme available to us. And strangely, generally, they're then content with a digital copy, lo and behold. So that is one of the things I've seen done. Just quickly to double back very, very briefly on the rights management platform conversation, Lawrence makes an excellent point, which is in terms of what the purpose of all this is, that they are most likely harvesting data. Anything free, as they say, means that your data is the currency for that transaction. Very astute. I've got a bit of a scenario here to put to you, Carrie, because this is an interesting one from Julia, where she says that effectively a case where a SAR request was made from an individual directly, an erasure request rather, and after that, they requested to see some ID for the individual to make sure it's the right person. And the individual has said that it's not reasonable to ask for a copy of their ID since this is an erasure request and they received a newsletter that they did not know that they were opted into. So effectively, they've received a newsletter. They've gone, why am I receiving this? Please delete me from your records. Yeah. And I don't want to provide ID. Do we still respond or do we refuse? What do you reckon? Sorry to put you on the spot. It's unfair. I don't do this to Dave and Phil.
Thanks. I feel really special. I'd have thought that with it just being an email and a newsletter, I think you'd have to sort of consider what is the purpose of the newsletter. Is it just pure marketing where consent would be the appropriate lawful basis? I mean, could the organisation in the background look to see whether appropriate consent was received from that email address, regardless of whether that person is the correct complainant or not? I think normally with a erasure request, you would ask for ID, but I think in this case, it's tricky. You put me on the spot.
Yeah, no, that's...
It could be that you offer, you know, and say, look, this is how you can remove yourself from the email, you know, checking that the emails all have that easy opt-out link at the bottom. You know, if you don't want to go ahead and delete it when you're not sure who the person is.
No, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, the guidance is that you should request ID only where it's reasonable to do so. So I think taking that into account, unless there's any reason not to, I'd have thought that removing someone from a mailing list and erasing their information would be proportionate to do potentially without ID if it's only in relation to that. But again, it's worth bearing in mind that obviously erasure requests are very specific. In terms of when they apply, unlike SARS. So I'd have thought that it's well, without knowing too much about it, I'd have thought it's probably proportionate to go ahead without ID, but there might be circumstances which dictate otherwise. Andrea, do you want to come in again?
Yeah, just because I've literally recently I've dealt with this in my company. So I have looked at the ID validation process and guidance for various supervisory authorities in UK, Europe as well. And the common element that I found is they all don't actually specifically provide practical guidance, but the common element is if you as a data controller have reasonable doubt about the identity of your data subject, you should ask for further identification, and nothing new, so no new information, just something that you have on your systems for them to confirm. Usually we have an email account, yeah? So that's what we do. We are actually we never ask for any new information. We always ask to confirm the email they created their account with, which is a common global approach, only if we don't have that email on the system. Sure. So, and also lawyers, specialist lawyers, advise the same. I mean, it's not, and GDPR doesn't say that every company has to go and spend time and resources on this. If you have reasonable doubt that the identity of the data subject, you know, it's unclear, then you can go and ask that information. But you cannot, as a company, be expected to go, give me this. Are you sure? I don't know. Maybe his email was hacked. Was it him who sent me the email? I don't know. Do you see? So we're not actually, we can't do that. We don't have the resources and the budget. So that's my understanding and based on research I've done. You send me an email. Does it look like it's coming from a legitimate email? Do I have the email on my system? Okay. Is it any reasonable doubt why I should believe it's not you? I'm not going to go here on a, you know, hunting exercise. I don't have the time resources. So yeah, we take it as it is. If you are in doubt, then you go and ask for the details. That's anyway how we see it.
Yeah, and I tend to agree with you on that. And I think what is coming out of both what you're saying and some of the interactions in the chat is that at the end of the day, it's a case-by-case basis. And as Rick very succinctly puts, if they're more sensitive records, then you need to take further steps to verify ID. But broadly, it's not always necessary. So hopefully that helps, Julia. I have seen an instance recently, actually, where someone did forge signatures and records to try and get access to information. So it happens. But as you say, Andrew, you know, you can only take reasonable steps in that context. So, yeah, it is interesting because it's something that we do come across a lot. Where is it appropriate? Where is it not? I realise now that we're not really providing tips so much as just discussing broader issues, Gary. So,
yeah,
to get us a little bit back on track, do you want to give us another tip that we can look at?
Yeah, I think one of the important ones that you've noted down is scoping. We'll go with that one. Making sure you know what you're looking for, what you may be coming up against as well, challenges with fulfilling the SAR ahead of time at the start, because it can help minimise your workload as well. If you know what you're looking for, if you know where things are, you know, getting all the information up front as much as you can. I've always found as well that having context about circumstances can be helpful as well, so you know what you're getting into when you're reviewing it. You know, are you going to come across anything that might be particularly upsetting in a SAR for a person to read? Are you going to come up against a lot of family members, like a bit of a tangled web that you need to try and figure out what they're allowed and what they're not allowed? The more context you can give somebody who's going to be reviewing that SAR, the better, because then they can go into it knowing what they're going to be reading going ahead.
Yeah, 100%. That's something I've got down here, which is you know, making sure that you've got the right people effectively, both I think from a training perspective, so making sure they understand how some of the exemptions work, what you can and can't give out, but also actually having people who are close to the situation, quote unquote, because, you know, as you say, it's a lot of the time, particularly it has to be said in social housing, but also I suspect in certain aspects of the public sector, I'm sure, you can get very complicated situations which, you know, people put SARS in about, and potentially very tense situations and very delicate situations. So really important to have the right people available to help you with that. One of the things I've also put down, and this isn't really a tip, but I think a warning possibly more than anything, because frankly, I still can't believe that I'm seeing this type of thing happen, which is only put things in writing that you wouldn't mind other people seeing. Because I still can't believe the number of times that I get asked about, shall we say, unsavory emails turning up in SARS. Do we have to disclose this? It's a bit embarrassing. Well, yeah, you do. You know, we have to, whether it's communication aspect from the relevant, you know, governance departments to the rest of the staff, or whether it's just, I don't know where the issue comes from, but we all have to be better at this. And you just cannot have, in this day and age, with the right of access available, people putting things in emails or in messages that they shouldn't be saying about others. It's just baffling, quite frankly. And I see it too often.
I've seen it before, and I've ended up having to email the people because they might have provided the information but not be directly involved in the SAR. As they just send a bunch of stuff over and you're going through it, and it's like, I've had to email them and say, look, you have written this down here. There is absolutely no way I can withhold this because it's their personal data. It's going to get disclosed. You know, FYI, nothing you can do about it. You know, please don't write snotty comments about people in emails.
Exactly. As Kerry says, if you wouldn't put it in a postcard, don't put it in an email. Quite right.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things, actually, and again, this is kind of related to this, in fact it is what Michael's saying, which is warning all staff that not only emails are auditable, but Teams is as well, because I think that is a very slippery slope, particularly when you have remote working of people pinging each other messages backwards and forwards. And because of the more instant nature of it and the possibly more informal nature of it, I think it really lends itself to people, you know, firing across potentially unsavory messages to one another. But it's still accessible, so that's something to be aware of. Ian raised a great question, which is about WhatsApp on personal phones. WhatsApp, frankly, is a bit of a nightmare. I've had a customer recently who... So basically, I can't say too much, obviously, but effectively, there was widespread use of WhatsApp within the business, but this wasn't recognized as an official communication channel, but everyone was doing it. And a former member of staff put in a SAR and said, well, hang on a second, you've not given me any of the WhatsApp messages. And then there had to be a real, you know, argument about the fact that, well, yes, we did all use it, but it wasn't technically a recognized official channel. And you're starting to get yourself into some pretty murky waters there. Those who are regular listeners, and as Rick's alluding to there, might remember that a couple months ago we discussed the fact that the applicability of FOIA to WhatsApp messages between cabinet ministers had been considered. I don't know if anyone remembers that. I don't know if you remember that, Carrie, but it's quite interesting to consider. I mean, obviously FOIA is a very different kettle of fish, but,
yeah,
you know, in terms of the applicability, it can definitely get messy. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to be able to control these systems, which is one of the things I've got on my list here as a top tip, is be really confident and cast iron on the systems you use and ensure that you can retrieve information, that you can control them, and that people are aware what is and isn't allowed effectively in relation to those systems. It's a real issue. But I've been talking and ranting about this for sufficiently long, Carrie, so why don't you take another tip while I keep an eye on the chat?
So I think another one you've picked up is here, systems, making sure they're set up to cope. Because you can't say information is spread across too many areas. I think the ICO recently updated their SAR guidance. I think it made it a little bit harder for companies and organisations to use excuses of, oh, it's too hard to get the information, or it's too many people involved, it they made it a little bit harder, I think, to extend deadlines based on the size of a SAR.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they sort of tightened up on what would become under the scope of complexity. And so I think it's sort of making sure that your systems are in such an order and that people are recording information correctly and in such a way that when you do get a SAR, it's easy to locate and it's easy to pull that information back out of it.
Yes, quite right. You're spot on. I think that's one of the things that they have driven increasingly, which is that, and this kind of relates back to the MOJ enforcement we were talking about, which is that your system's not being set up to cope is no longer a valid excuse. I mean, it never really was, but it's more so now than ever not a valid excuse. And WhatsApp sort of, I guess, falls into that as well. Rick, I see you got your hand up. I am paying attention. Don't worry. Do you want to jump in?
Yeah, thanks, Carrie. Yeah, just a concern. I put it in the chat a way back, but I just wanted to raise it with you guys for just thoughts, really. So it's an identifiability concern. So with SARs in general, so we had a data subject request a right to be forgotten or erase a request. And in this case, we've run through it with them and explained that we can't erase their information, but we can, you know, we can give them a restriction. So we can restrict that processing because we've got a regulatory requirement to keep their, mm-hmm. you know, retain their records for X amount of times. So in this case, so we've done the full restriction so that their, you know, their account is not accessible by anyone within the business. But then they're following up with a subject access request. And because that record is then locked for all intents and purposes, do we then say to them, actually, we don't have you on record? Or do we then say, yes, we do have you on record? And they can say that actually they're not restricted appropriately. So it's a bit of a complicated one. Just one.
Crikey, it is, yeah.
So in that case, do you just say, nope, you know, we can't find you on the record? Or do you then say, we believe that then you may be on record? Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really know what to do with that one. So thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's the sort of situation where I'd be inclined to. I'm just thinking out loud. So if it's completely wrong, you're all okay to chastise me on this. But I think that's the sort of situation where I'd very much take the approach of, well, the right is to understand how your information is being processed, not necessarily sort of gain a copy of any of it all. And I say that because that'd be the type of situation where I'd be inclined to say, well, you know, we explained to you previously in your erasure request that we couldn't delete certain things because we had a regulatory requirement. We therefore restricted them. This means that there is still a file for you on the system. However, it is locked down in the following ways. Now, you might expose yourself there if they feel it's not appropriate, but at a certain point, you know, it's down to you to take the measures which you feel are appropriate, and if you've gone through those steps, then I guess it's about being confident in them.
And also, what I was thinking, if you then restricted access to their details, are you then required to remove details of their SAR request in general, so they're then on the list of people that have requested? So if they keep on requesting and they keep on erasing their request, does that then mean we've got no record of their excessive requests?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I've always, well, this is sort of straying into erasure more than access, but sure. Always made the point whenever responding, saying, you know, this erasure request, we have deleted the following information, the following records, but you need to be aware that this erasure request in and of itself leaves a trace, and we have to maintain that for our audit purposes. We have to make sure that, you know, we have fulfilled this request for you. And, you know, in case we're ever challenged about it, or in case you ever ask us about it again. And today I've not been challenged on that. Generally, people are pretty happy to say, yeah, that seems reasonable that you'd keep a trace amount of information. But you're right, there is a tension there. Yeah. That's quite all right. I'm just having a look through the chat, keeping an eye. We've managed to fill an hour almost. Even more efficiently, Carrie, than I would with the other two. So well done to you on that. I don't know whether I'm not entirely sure what it's in relation to, but Jackie mentions retention schedules. And I'm going to take that opportunity to talk a little bit about retention, because that, for those of you who were on the previous session we did about SARs, was my key recommendation. And it remains the same, which is that really The entire process of simplifying SARs starts with your retention. And if you, I mean, it's as simple as if you haven't got it, then you can't disclose it, right? Ultimately, if your retention processes are in place and they're right, and you're not over retaining anything, that you're only keeping the bare minimum, then already you've made a good, you know, a strong step in simplifying that process for yourself. Because one of the number one issues with SARs that we get back is either we've got mountains because we've not got retention criteria in place, which, you know, is a common theme. It's not to point fingers at anyone, but, you know, it does happen. But that's one of the main things. Or the other being that, oh, well, we store all of our information in emails currently because we're not set up properly, and therefore we've got, you know, 250,000 emails to sort through. So I just wanted to bring that up, retention, Carrie, because to me that is an absolutely huge one.
And like if you're a public sector authority as well and you come under FOIA, same applies there. If people are asking you for information under FOIA, if you don't have it, you can't give it, and therefore you don't have to answer the request. You can say no, information not held. So like retention, keeping on top of that comes in handy across the board, I think. Not just SAR, but pretty much everywhere. But yeah, I think sometimes when people request SARs, they maybe don't realise how much an organisation is holding about them. And that's purely because the organisation hasn't kept on top of retention. Yeah, especially emails, they can be a sticking point.
Yeah, 100%. I was trying to, in the build-up to this, I was trying to come up with sort of a catchy little phrase for this retention thing. And those of you who know us as a business know that we're based in Yorkshire, so I was trying to string something together along the lines of, if you retain now, you won't have out to disclose, but it's not particularly catchy, so I might leave that. I need Dave here. He's the one that normally comes up with catchphrases and you know, clever hooks for things. So Carrie, we've managed to fill the hour. We could go on all afternoon, and I'm sure there are plenty of people who would be happy for us to do that, but so I know that you're on holiday. You're on holiday this afternoon, so I don't want to keep you. So any final thoughts from you on this? We didn't even work through all of our recommendations because there's so much to talk about. But any final thoughts?
I think with SARs, it's just staff awareness is key to getting them in and out on time. It's getting staff aware of what one looks like, who to send it to, getting on top of like ID, getting information from people, because you may not be able to access it all yourself. When I was council, we had to get information from different people sometimes, especially with HR ones. I want emails from all these people, and it's getting those emails to those people on time, and those people also understanding that this is a priority. It's not something to put to the bottom of their to-do pile because they want to do something else first. It's a priority. There's a legislative deadline to getting these things out, and I think it's really a team effort with SARs, and that everybody should understand that.
Yeah,
it's not just down to one person to get it out. There's multiple different cogs that all need to work together.
100%. I could not agree with you more. I will re-emphasize my point about retention, although I completely hear what you're saying, Jackie, which is that you know, there are sort of statutory requirements around certain retention periods that can't be ignored, and as Michael says, make sure you're not deleting stuff on the day of the request, lest you may find yourself in relatively big trouble. I think we'll probably have to conclude it there for today, but there's still so much to talk about. I can't believe that I actually put together a contingency plan in the notes saying if we have time to fill,
what shall we talk about? Like, there's too much. You could easily go on for 2 hours, 3 hours about SARs, I think.
It was foolish of me to assume that we wouldn't have enough to talk about. I mean, yeah, I should know at this point. But people on the session saying that they think that we should be doing another one because it's a big subject. We do have a list of events already set up, which Miles manages for us. But Miles, I'm sure we can find a gap later in the year for another session, or maybe move things around, you never know, and insert another session on SARs, because it is a massive topic. You know, there's so much to talk about. There's loads that we haven't even gotten through, or that we haven't covered in sufficient detail, I feel. So you know, I think I'd definitely be keen to do another one. Miles, what do you reckon? When can we squeeze one in, or are we going to have to look to later in the year?
I agree, Ollie. I think we'll look to move some things around maybe and get one in soon. We do have a list of events coming up, but there's not too many events that are set in stone, and we can definitely dedicate a GDPR radio week to one worst case scenario. So I'd expect a session, follow up and part two on this within the month, hopefully.
Within the month, there we are, folks. Miles has set down the gauntlet. We're going to have to keep to that. So within the month, we'll do a follow-up. We'll do another one. Carrie, will you join us for that one again?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we didn't even get to vent about the worst SARs we've seen and bad practice that we've seen.
No.
So we definitely need to get some of those in next time, I think.
I think we do.
Don't do it like this.
Absolutely. I'll look forward to you joining me again on that one. I'd like to congratulate you on what has been a fantastic debut. These sessions aren't easy, and I've thrown you a couple of curveballs as well, although you've not had to deal with Dave, so you've gotten off lightly in some respects.
No, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
As have those on the session, hopefully. We do hope you enjoyed. We will be back next week with a GDPR radio session, which is effectively just an open surgery, so an opportunity for us to come and talk about what's been in the news, what we're working on, just share some knowledge, kick some things around. They're always really good sessions, so if you've not attended before, I highly encourage you to do so. If you would like to listen back or you can't make any future events, as I say, all of these go out on Spotify, Apple Music, all the audio streaming platforms afterwards, and on the DPP website, as Miles says. But for now, I will leave you to enjoy your weekends, and we hope to see you all very soon. Thank you, everyone.